This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
James Cobb is the Spalding Distinguished Research Professor of History at the University of Georgia. His most recent book is Away Down South, A History of Southern Identity, and he's also the author of The Cultural Roots of Disunion, a commentary recently published in the New York Times. Jim, it's an honor to have you on the program, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
So I find it really fascinating, the research that you've done on the antebellum period leading up to the Civil War and the identity that was already taking shape there, beginning with, the founding of America, about who the North is and who the South is. It was different from the very beginning, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly excuse me, was in the sense of interest, obviously, that you know, the colonial interest, you could see obvious differences going back to the point where the New England colonies become, you know, more involved in shipping and commerce, and the southern colonies, of course, are producing the agricultural staples for export. But the sort of politics of regional difference, it strikes me as intriguing that the normal interpretation of the background to the Civil War has the South sort of starting sectional politics and agitating for its own narrow sectional interests, when really New Englanders were as one historian, I think, called them the most precocious sectionalists by far in the United States, because they were angling to sort of make New England the prototype for the whole country, and sort of celebrating the values of New England as if they were foreordained to be the values of America. And they began this at the end of the 18th century, and it's sort of a well-developed phenomena by 1820 or so.
We're talking with Jim Cobb at the University of Georgia. You write in your article that as early as the 1814 Hartford Convention following the War of 1812, that Federalists in New England were already threatening to secede from the Union.
Yeah, that a lot of people don't realize that New England had already been toying with secession a long time before Southerners developed that very bad idea. The New England states had not been in favor of the War of 1812. Of course, it was going to disrupt their commerce and shipping. And so they were also looking at the loss of population as New Englanders moved into more attractive western territories, and the New England states were just sort of beginning to see themselves as a future minority, and they were doing their best to sort of leverage the influence they once had to get a more favorable political stance as far as the rest of the country is concerned toward New England. And when it didn't come, there was a considerable talk, actually, of the New England states seceding.
That is amazing. We're talking with Jim Cobb, professor of history at the University of Georgia. His books include Away Down South, A History of Southern Identity, and Georgia Odyssey, A Short History of the State. And he also wrote recently in the New York Times a commentary about the cultural roots of disunion and what led to the Civil War. So that, but I guess then by the time that we see secessionist talk in the South, it was already, if I understand you right, that was already a very well-established idea that came out of New England, that was actually created and birthed in the politics of New England Federalists.
Yes, although it became more apparent that New England was going to actually have a lot in common with the new free states that were being settled, which is basically approximates the Midwest now. They downplayed this whole episode, and of course were a tad embarrassed by it, because once again the whole idea was you know, the idea of New England, the fundamental belief in free labor and opportunity, individual opportunity, would become again the the national ideology, and so that you don't by that point, by say the end of the 1820s, when you are starting to get some talk of secession around the tariff crises that came at the end of the 20s and early 30s, there is this sense in which there's less talk of New England interests, or certainly not talk of Northern interests per se, because these interests were already sort of fixed in the minds of people outside the South as being totally congruent with national interests. That what they wanted was in the national interest, even if it just quite so coincidentally, of course, was also in the interest of the Northeast and the emerging Midwest.
Yeah, so they certainly had a disproportionate political sentiment or representation in Washington that favored the North.
Well, by the middle of the 19th century, that's becoming apparent. The population growth is greatest, even though New England has lost population. Many of these migrants have moved to the Midwestern states, which are attracting at that point the greatest streams of migration, because labor didn't have to compete with slavery after all in the free states. So there is then the thinking that basically the North needs a political party. It needs a unifying organization to represent it, and that is how, in part, around the issue of opposing the spread of slavery, that the Republican Party comes into being.
Yeah.
And at its inception, it is a purely sectional party. It's a purely Northern party, but it does represent a part of the country that is soon going to be the single largest region population-wise.
If you just joined us, it's 5:16, 39 degrees in Charlottesville. We're talking with Professor of History and an expert on Southern history and culture, James Cobb from the University of Georgia. His most recent books are Georgia Odyssey and A Way Down South. I'm curious the focus on slavery in the South on the part of this new Republican Party that really represented New England Federalists as its base, was it really motivated out of an opposition to slavery, or was an opposition to slavery and the slavery issue used as a tool to sort of bring the party together and more people under the tent?
Well, it was motivated. I mean, there certainly was an abolitionist component, which, as you know, was centered primarily in New England, although it does start to show up in some of the Western free states. But so there's that component, but the idea of free labor is not, it shouldn't be confused with anti-slavery so much as protecting the realm of opportunity for the free white laborer. Dictated an anti-slavery policy to the extent that slavery not be allowed to move into states which were also receiving heavy migration from white free labor. So it was less a question of championing the cause of enslaved African Americans, or of even demanding an end to the institution of slavery within the South as it was then constituted, than it was simply the idea of keeping slavery out of these new states. And when the Republicans sort of finally come together in the mid-1850s, the one thing that you could guarantee that a Republican would all Republicans would agree on was that slavery should not be allowed to expand.
That's really fascinating, but not so much because they disliked slavery in the South, but because you had white laborers who didn't want to compete with slave labor.
Yes, I mean that the free soil movement sort of merges with the abolitionist cohort within the Republican Party, but the free soil movement again is about free soil for white settlement without competition from from slave labor.
Yeah, that is fascinating. We're talking with Jim Cobb at the University of Georgia, an expert on Southern history and culture. Now, Jim, let's turn our attention to one of the tools that the South used to create identity for itself in opposition to this growing political movement in the North, this Republican Northern movement. The South used the idea of the honorable English cavalier, which, of course, here in Charlottesville with the University of Virginia Cavaliers, the mascot. Tell us about the origins of this very idea of the cavalier in the South.
Well, you begin to notice it in the 1830s because by that time, many observers, beginning actually with foreign travelers, American travelers as well across the country, detected these perceived cultural differences between the frugal, hardworking, serious New Englanders, and the more leisurely, hospitable, less to the observer anyway, less mercenary Southerners, and so part of the explanation for this disparity in cultural types was that Southerners were actually descended from the aristocratic cavaliers who had been forced out of England during the English Civil War at the middle of the 17th century and had been actually recruited to Virginia by Governor William Berkeley. And like all myths, I mean, it does have a germ of truth in it. The historian David Hackett Fisher wrote a huge tome on this whole question and does show that Berkeley did, in fact, actively recruit some of the Cavaliers, and who may have made up as much as, say, 25% of the wave of migration that comes to Virginia and at the middle of the 17th century. Supposedly, to make all this fit, there also is the belief that New England, that all of the sobriety and industry and frugality you saw in New England was a result of that region being settled by the Puritans, or the Roundheads, as they were disparagingly called, who had been the antagonists of the Cavaliers back in England during the Civil War and, of course, had been the supporters of Oliver Cromwell. So you get this idea, and it begins to show up really in literature as much as anything in the 1830s with novels that have the old cavalier, or at least the descendant of the cavaliers, living on grand estates in Virginia and sort of, living a life of great gentility and ease and displaying remarkable hospitality and doing all the things that one associated with the English aristocracy.
And there was an effort I find really interesting that there was an effort to actually put the image of a cavalier on the Confederate flag.
Well, on the Confederate seal, the national seal. The idea was by this time, what happens is that this debate or this dialogue about the Puritan cavalier dichotomy had really gotten severely overheated by 1860, and it was something that had been treated rather lightly. Some of the literary treatments, early literary treatments of the Cavaliers, had been actually satirical, called mildly poking fun at the whole Cavalier idea. But by 1860, these categorizations had sort of hardened into being totally antithetical, and the idea that you couldn't, you could never reconcile these two different cultures and have them live under one flag. So, in order, somebody had the rather bad idea, I should think, of to show the the cavalier makeup of American of Southern society to put the image of the cavalier on the seal of the Confederacy. But however, other people had the good sense to look around and say, well, you know, since 2/3 of the people we've got in case this comes to a fight are people who don't even own any slaves, maybe suggesting that you know, we are a land of aristocrats by putting a cavalier on the official seal of the Confederacy is probably not a good idea.
That's really something. Jim Cobb is a professor of history at the University of Georgia, an expert on Southern history and culture and tradition. Jim, it's been a great honor to have you on the program. I really appreciate your time.
Well, Coy, it's been great to be with you. I appreciate it very much.
Jim's most recent books include A Way Down South, A History of Southern Identity, and Georgia Odyssey, A Short History of the State. We'll take a really quick break. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.